All right, good evening, everyone. I'm excited to be here with you today to talk about holiness in the digital age. And as the PowerPoint's being pulled up, I just thought about what's the best way to kind of talk about our current culture and how it can dialogue with our faith and how it makes sense with our faith and how our faith can respond to it in some ways. And so I thought holiness in the digital age was a topic that I found was interesting and maybe interesting for you guys as well. And so I want to begin with this picture. Okay, does anyone know what this game is? Hands up if you know what this game is. Okay, a couple of people, So this game is called Flappy Bird. And if you haven't seen Flappy Bird before, no worries, I was prepared for this. So we have a video to show you what this game is. So that's the game. So the whole point of the game is this. You have a bird and you are flapping. And so what you do is you tap the screen and you're moving along. And as you tap, your bird moves up and it tries to move through the pipes. If you go through the pipes, the more pipes you go through, the more points you get. But if you hit a pipe, then you kind of die. So as you can see, when you're watching that, you find like, oh, actually, that looks like a pretty difficult game. And so when it came out in 2013, in May, it actually wasn't very popular at all. People are like, oh, that's too hard, I don't like it, all this stuff. But for some reason, in January of 2014, it just got tons of downloads overnight, thousands of downloads overnight, and it became like a raving sensation. It became wildly popular. In its heyday, it made about $50,000 per day in ad revenue. So people were going crazy over it. It was amazing. And so one of the creators, his name is Dong. So one of my countrymen. So I'm a proud Vietnamese person bringing Vietnamese food and Flappy Bird to Western civilization. So you'd think that if you're making $50,000 a day, you'd be super happy and excited. But for Dong, he actually wasn't. And the reason why was because he was reading the comments under the app. Under each app, there's always like comments and people rate it and stuff like that. And here are some of the things that the people said. So the first comment is this. It came from JSum79. It says, Flappy Bird ruined my life. Its side effects are worse than cocaine / meth. You're like, whoa, what's going on here? Next comment, Walter19230. There's like a title. It says, The Apocalypse. He says, my life is over. And finally, for MXND, Flappy Bird will be the death of me. Let me start by saying, do not download Flappy Bird. People warned me, but I didn't care. I don't sleep, I don't eat, and I'm losing friends. And so I bring up Flappy Bird as an example, and this is kind of extreme, on the extreme end for some people. But what we can see with our technology is that it has a way of drawing us into its worship. And so the whole theme I'm going to be talking about for this talk is we worship what we love and we become what we love. And so my idea here is to look at our technology, but not just to give you some information about it, but also to help you reflect theologically for yourself and for those you love, your grandchildren and children, and to see, wow, what are the effects of technology and how are we able to respond to it in a way as Christians, but also in a way that helps us to become saints with our cell phones. And so we'll talk about the Silicon Valley. And we'll talk about this marketing technique. It's called dog fooding. So dog fooding is this technique. It came from the story of this guy. He was selling dog food, and he came into his marketing meeting one day, and he just started eating his own dog food. And then people were like, whoa, what's going on? That's really weird. Why are you eating your dog food, man? And so the reason why he was eating his own dog food was this. If the dog food is good enough for me, it's good enough for your dog, right? So, I mean, that's not the best application of that, but that's how he did it, right? But you can see that in that application in other things, right? If this t-shirt is good enough for me, if I'm wearing it, then it should be good enough for you. But what we realize, especially in the Silicon Valley, is that they do not eat their own dog food, which is really interesting. And so when we look to Melinda Gates, we find that she said this quote. She says, you know, if I had the choice, I would have waited a little bit longer before the kid. So she was thinking like maybe like 15 years old before they would have been using technology. So that's like, whoa, what's going on? And then this guy, he interviewed Steve Jobs. And he said, and at this point, the iPad has just come out. So he's like, so your kids must love the iPad. And then Steve Jobs says, they haven't used it. We limit how much technology they use in the house. And the interviewer was just like flabbergasted, his jaw just dropped. And he says, you know, I imagine the Jobs household was like a nerd's paradise. The walls were touchscreen, the kitchen table was full of iPads, and they were handing out iPods like from a couch, like candy, like chocolate when you come into the house, right? And then Steve Jobs said, nope, not even close. And then the third thing is this. When you find out, when you talk to the Silicon Valley people, and then you find out what school they're going to, they actually send them to a special school in the Silicon Valley that does not introduce them to technology until the eighth grade, which is crazy. So, time out. So do they know something that we don't know? What's going on? Why aren't they eating their own dog food? And so, what we can do is we can talk about, I want to talk about three ways. I want to begin with this guy, and his name is Asa Raskin. You don't know Asa Raskin, but you definitely know the technology he has designed. He's designed something that's called the Infinite Scroll. So the Infinite Scroll is something you find on Instagram and Facebook, and when you're checking your phone, you can scroll infinitely. But what's interesting about this technique or this strategy was that it's based on some scientific studies. They found that if you were eating soup, and if someone was secretly filling the bowl without you knowing it, you would actually consume more soup than you had planned. And when I heard about this study, it just blew my mind because I've had those experiences, or maybe you've had as well, either on Facebook, Instagram, or even YouTube, where you're just scrolling, and you're like, I don't even care what this thing is about, I just keep scrolling. And so I'm like, wow, that just kind of blew my mind. And the kind of the new wave of this is the infinite play. Instead of the infinite scroll, they have the infinite play now on YouTube, Facebook, or even Netflix, where you're just watching a show, and after you're done, it starts with the next episode. And the reason why it's so effective in helping us watch more videos or scroll through more things is that there's no stopping cues. When you read a book and you finish, that's a stopping cue. It's over, right? You know, 10 years ago when you watched a TV episode and it ended, that's a stopping cue, and you would have to wait till next week to watch the episode. But now, we have everything at our fingertips, and it can be infinite. And so that's one of the tricks that I think social media and technology uses to draw us in. Now, onto the next slide. This is the like button. Now, the like button was actually designed by a lady, and her name was Leah Perlman. She was the co-inventor of the like button. And what's interesting about her story is that she actually became so addicted to the like button that she had to draw away from it. She doesn't manage her own Facebook account anymore. She has to have someone else manage her own Facebook account, which is kind of crazy. The person who designed the like button got so hooked onto it. She said, I became addicted to the feedback. And so there's this interesting story about Hipstamatic. Has anyone heard of Hipstamatic? Hipstamatic used to be like this ancient kind of camera. And so what they did was they tried to reboot it with an app called Hipstamatic 100. And it began in 2009. And it became so popular that it actually became the app of 2010. Apple called it the app of the year. So what this app did was that it allowed you to take photos, but then you could turn it into like a retro kind of vintage frame kind of thing in a way. So it's something that we can do now easily, but back then, 10 years ago, that was like revolutionary. Like, wow, this is so cool, right? So it became the most popular app in 2010. At the same time in 2010, there was another app that came out. And it was very similar to Hipstamatic, but eventually it started gaining traction. Hipstamatic probably topped out around 5 million downloads, but this app topped up is now around 300 million downloads. And in 2011, it became the app of the year, declared by Apple. So this app, the reason why this app is different because of two things. One is because they allowed free downloads. So when someone would download the app, it'd be easy entry, right? So you wouldn't have to pay anything, right? But just because an app is free doesn't mean that it's be good. So what's unique about this app is that it has its own social network. So it allows you to share photos, because Hipstamatic allowed you to share photos, but you had to upload it to Facebook. Whereas this app was like its own Facebook, where you could constantly share photos. And so they took two names and put them together, Instant and Telegram, and that's how you get Instagram. So in 2012, 2 years after this app has come out, Mark Zuckerberg bought it for $1 billion. Imagine that. You do an app, you work for 2 years and you make $1 billion. And right now, guess how much it is? It's worth about $100 billion. And why did Mark Zuckerberg buy it? Because he knows, because he designed Facebook. He had that sense and intuition that people crave of affirmation, validation, and the comparison. And he saw that in Instagram, and that's why he bought it. And so in a way, these apps kind of feed on our potential insecurities, the need to be loved, the need to be desired, the need to be valued through likes or hearts. And so that's the second tool. And then the third tool, I think, is the strongest tool. I'd say it's pigeons. So not quite pigeons, but... So this is how it works. They did another study with some rats. And what they did was they put these probes in these rats' brains. And what they wanted the rat to do was go up to this lever, push the lever, have a shock in their brain, and then run back to the other side. And so they did this for a bunch of these rats. And all of the rats, they would go up, push the button, and then run back. Except for one rat. Rat number 34. Rat number 34 would go up, it would push the lever, and it would get the shock, but it wouldn't run back. It actually just stayed there, and 5 seconds later, it pushed it again. Not only did it push it again, it pushed it 7,000 times for 12 hours. It pushed it so much that it died of exhaustion after those 12 hours. And so the scientists were like, what is this rat doing? What was going on there? And when they looked into the brain of the rat, they realized that the probe was not in the exact same spot as the other rats, that this probe was kind of bent a little bit and kind of into the center of the brain, which we now know as the pleasure center of the brain. And so that's where, so what the electrical surges were doing was giving it, the rat, the dopamine rush, the feel-good hormone, and so it was going, oh man, that was awesome, 7,000 times, and then it died. Now, luckily for us, social media giants know that they can't put a probe in our brain, because that'd be crazy. But they did this other study with pigeons. So they isolated these pigeons in these cages. And what these pigeons would do was that they would have to push this button. And so the button, there's two scenarios. In one scenario, when the pigeons pushed the button, they would get food pellets every time. And then they wanted to compare that with another scenario where every time the pigeons pushed the button, it would receive food on an intermittent basis, on a variable time, like maybe every third or fifth or second. They didn't know. And they try to predict, like, what do you think, which would the pigeon get more addicted to? The regular basis or kind of the variable basis? And what they found was that it was actually the variable rewards that made the pigeons more addicted. They would push it hundreds of times in the day. So it's called variable intermittent rewards. And what it does is it actually releases a greater dopamine rush at that when you receive that reward. And we actually know this, and you guys probably have this experience too, that's how slot machines work, right? When you pull in the slot machine, you're like, oh man, am I going to win? Oh no, and then like, shh. And then you pull again, like, yeah, I got it. Poof, dopamine, happiness, yay, right? Now, this is the other crazy thing about technology. All of us, and even our children, potentially have a slot machine in our pockets. Think about it. When you pick up your phone, it's like, gee, I wonder if I got that text message. Like, oh, I didn't, right? Like, gee, I wonder if I got it. Oh, and then you get it, and you're just like, oh, happiness. Yeah. And so what can happen is we can become addicted to checking our phone, whether it could be likes, shares, even email could give people a dopamine rush, potentially. I know some people are like, no, I don't know about emails, man. I don't like emails. And so, because they say on average, we check our phone about 157 times a day. Wow. And so I've been trying to use these apps to kind of track how many times I use my phone per day to kind of see, right? And so I've been trying to negate that a little bit. And so this is really interesting how our technology has hooked us in these three ways. And so if we move to the next slide, we'll find out why are we so hooked into this technology? And Tristan Harris, he was a Google design ethicist, so he used to work at Google, but he doesn't anymore. And so he used to think about, okay, how do we ethically use technology to steer people's thoughts, right? And basically the reason why technology, in a way, tries to hook us into it is because it's all about ad revenue, right? Companies are trying to make money. So the more time you spend on an app or a website, the more money the company makes. Now, if other companies are vying for your attention, they're all going to try to make their individual technologies maximally addicting, right? Asa Raskin says, it's like pouring behavioral cocaine over your interface. And this is what Tristan Harris also says in the next slide, this. He says, there are 1,000 people on the other side of the screen whose job it is to break down the self-regulation you have. Right? They're trying to make you use it more for an evil or a good intent. You know, I don't know. I wouldn't say that's necessarily their intent, but part of it is they want to make money. And the longer you're on it, the more money they make. Right? And so I bring up these topics because it makes us question a lot of things. And so there's a quick activity I want you guys to do. And so what we're going to do right now is I want you guys to read these questions. And it's an internet addiction test. So this is a sample, so you can kind of see like where you are on the spectrum. And so what we're going to do, we're going to read the question, and then you can say either always, often, frequently, occasionally, or rarely. And then you can add up the results, and then keep that number, and I'll tell you where you fall on the addiction cycle. So how often do you find that you stay online longer than you intended? So you can keep your number in your mind. Okay, rarely, often, always, well, I don't know. How often do others in your life complain to you about the amount of time you spend online? How often do you check your email before something else that you need to do? How often do you lose sleep because of late night logins? How often do you find yourself saying, just a few minutes when online? Okay, so you guys got your total? You guys ready for this? Are you ready? Okay. So, if you are 7 below, there are no signs of internet addiction. If you are 8 to 12, you have a mild internet addiction, but you're still in control. 13 to 20, moderate internet addiction causing you problems. 21 to 25, severe internet addiction giving you significant problems, right? So I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. You don't have to reveal your... But imagine if we were asking our youth in our schools, wonder what their score would be. 31, you know? So we talked about if you worship what you love, you become what you love, right? Your love is what is your highest love? That's what you worship. That's what the word worship comes from. Worth-ship. What is of highest worth to you, right? And so the next part of this is like, if we worship what we love, we become what we love, right? And so what are the effects of technology on us? And so Consumer Insights Microsoft Canada talks about attention spans. So in 2000, our average human attention span was around 12 seconds. The average human attention span in 2013 is 8 seconds. And 2000, I think it was 2010 or 2012 was when the iPhone came out. Guess what the average attention span of a goldfish is? 9 seconds. So I don't know about you, but I've had that experience too where I just felt like if I'm getting text messages, if you get like 6 text messages in an hour, you're trying to work, it takes forever to finish whatever you're trying to do, right? And so our technology is in a way distracting us, right? You've heard as well, maybe there's actually this term, it's called Facebook envy. That's actually like a mental health issue that people are really experiencing because they're seeing the lives of other people and then they're like, man, my life isn't like that. Their life is amazing, right? And you've probably heard the studies of how social media affects your mental health and all these different things. But I want to focus on a particular aspect, which I will call digital existentialism. So for those of you who did the Bishop Robert Barron study with us last year, we heard of the term existentialism. That term came from Ludwig Feuerbach in the 19th century and Jean-Paul Sartre in the 20th century. And the basic idea behind existentialism is this, is that my existence precedes my essence. And you're like, that doesn't help. So existence preceding your essence is this, is that my freedom comes before my identity. I don't conform to some preconceived idea of God has for me. I create my identity in who I am. And so although you may not have heard the idea of existentialism before, you've heard of its effects, right? I think a couple months ago or last year, there was a story about a man who was 69, and he says, I want to identify as a 49-year-old, right? I don't feel 69, I feel like I'm 49, right? And the reason why he wanted to be identified as 49 was because he wanted to get dates or something, and he couldn't legally put it or something like that, right? An extreme example, I would say, is this guy, he's called the Dragon Man. And so if you like Google Dragon Man, it's pretty disturbing. I didn't have a picture of it. What he did was he cut off his ears, cut his nose, put slits for his nose, and he slit his tongue. And then he tattooed his face to look like a dragon, right? So that's an extreme form of existentialism, right? I don't conform to any idea of human being. I choose who I want to be. If I feel like a dragon, then I am a dragon, right? And so we can see how this thought process is pervading our society in different ways, right? And so the reason why I have pictures of chains here is because Jean-Paul Sartre said that if God existed, it'd be like a permanent North Korea. Our freedom would be impinged. But because we know we're free, we know that therefore God does not exist. And so I'm free to choose to be who I am. Yet I think what's interesting for our digital age is something I call digital existentialism, where not only do we create ourselves in this world, we create ourselves online. And so you probably have seen the Dove commercials, right? With the lady, and then this is before, and this is after, and how they've kind of like elongated her neck, changed her lips, kind of lengthened her nose, and all these different things, right? And so we're able to create ourselves in some ways online. But by doing that, I think it has some significant effects on who we are and how we understand ourselves. And so I want to show you a quick video. This video is called The Innovation of Loneliness, and this is a clip from it.
Texting, email, posting, all of these things let us present the self as we want it to be. We get to edit, and that means we get to delete. Instead of building true friendships, we're obsessed with endless personal promotion, investing hours on end building our profile, pursuing the optimal order of words in our next message, choosing the pictures in which we look our best, all of which is meant to serve as a desirable image of who we are. We're expecting more from technology and less from each other. The social networks aren't just changing what we're doing, but also who we are. And that's because technology appeals to us most where we are most vulnerable. And we are vulnerable. We are lonely, where we're afraid of intimacy, while the social networks offer us three gratifying fantasies. One, that we can put our attention wherever we want it to be. Two, that we will always be heard. And three, that we will never have to be alone. And that third idea, that we will never have to be alone, is central to changing our psyches. It's shaping a new way of being. The best way to describe it is, I share. Therefore, I am. We use technology to define ourselves by sharing our thoughts and feelings, even as we're having them. Furthermore, we're faking experiences so we'll have something to share, so we can feel alive. We slip into thinking that always being connected is going to make us feel less alone, but we are at risk because the opposite is true. If we are not able to be alone, we're only going to know how to be lonely.
And so the point I want to highlight is this. You probably heard that statement from Descartes, is that I think, therefore I am. And so what Descartes did was he posited his identity in thought. But what's happening in our digital age right now is that I share, therefore I am. What I share on the internet becomes my identity. That's who I am. That's where I find my meaning and place and value. You might have heard of the story of Essena O'Neill. She was an Instagram model in Australia. And so what happened was she had 500,000 followers on Instagram. She was making like $2,000 per Instagram post. And she kind of had it all. She was very successful. But she came out with this video, and you've seen it online, and she says, and she's crying at this point. She's like, I don't even know what is real anymore. Her digital life and her real life almost blended together in how she wanted to perceive herself and to show herself, carefully curated. She said at one point she was taking this photo and I took this photo like 100 times just to make sure it was perfect. And I was yelling at my sister while I was doing it. And so that presentation online is affecting how we view our identity. And what's interesting is that, ironically, with technology, we can become connected, but alone, because we're not presenting our true selves, and we can develop these superficial relationships, or we put on these masks which prevent us from actually connecting with other people. So we worship what we love, we become what we love, right? Yet at the same time, I still believe that there's hope for our digital age. I don't believe that we have to be resigned to all these different things that are drawing us in. Because the reason why technology is able to hack into our biology, our psychology, it's because of our theology, our theological anthropology, who we are made in the image and likeness of God. Our technology says, oh, we have restless hearts, so let's make some money off of it. But we say, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee, O Lord. The infinite scroll can only grab us because we were made for the infinite God. Our technology wants us to worship it with all our heart, mind, and scroll. You see what I did? You see what I did? But God wants us to worship Him with all our heart, mind, and soul. And so what is that? That's what it means to be a saint. See, a saint does the reverse. In a sense, the saint follows the same pattern. The saint worships what it loves, and it becomes what it loves. And so the saint becomes this through two main ways, which I want to talk about. Through trust and silence. Trust and silence. When we think about the original sin, we normally think about, pride and disobedience, which is true. But when we actually look deeper into the story, I think there's a deeper meaning to it. Listen to what the Catechism says about this. Man, tempted by the devil, let his trust in his Creator die in his heart, and abusing his freedom, disobeyed God's command. This is what man's first sin consisted of. So the sin in the Garden of Eden was more than just like eating fruit. It was about distrusting God. And because of that, pride and then disobedience, right? God, I don't trust in you. I think I have a better plan than you. Therefore, I will disobey you. And so the deepest wounds that humans experience is distrust. And so in order to heal that distrust, we need to reverse it. We need to experience trust. And this is what Jesus does when he comes down. When he comes down to earth, especially during this Passion Week. Have you ever thought of the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why did he say that on the cross? Did you know that these words are actually words of absolute trust? You're like, wow, that's crazy. You're like, that doesn't make sense. When we think about it, it makes a lot more sense because those words, my God, why have you forsaken me, comes from Psalm 22. And it's the title of Psalm 22. And whenever you quote the title, you kind of evoke the meaning of the psalm as well, right? So when you think of O Canada, right, you think of, I say O Canada, you think of like our home and native land, patriotism and red flags and all those things, right? Or if I think, or if I say the words, my heart will go on, right? You'll think of Celine Dion, think of this bow tearing, and like, and you'll think of Jack, and all these meanings associated with it, right? So what is the meaning associated behind, my God, why have you forsaken me? The meaning behind it is this. It's a prayer of trust. It says, God, why have you abandoned me? I've been crying out for you, and I don't feel like you're hearing me. But I trust in you because you've delivered our ancestors, and I know you will deliver me. And then he says this beautiful part right here. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before him. What he's saying is that what's happening to me will somehow lead to all the nations worshiping you. And not only that, posterity shall serve him. Men shall tell of the Lord to the coming generation. That they're going to tell this for generations to come. Okay. Now take this and put it in the context of the crucifixion scene. Jesus is hanging on the cross, and the Pharisees and scribes are mocking him. You say you're the Son of God? Come down from that cross. You say God is your Father? Let him deliver you now. What does Jesus say? My God, why have you forsaken me? In other words, I know it looks like I'm suffering now, but I know that God will deliver me. Not only will he deliver me, because of my death, all the nations of the world, all the families of the nations shall come and worship before him, and all generations will speak of this moment from this day forth. Talk about a mic drop. You would have, back then they didn't have mics, so it would have been a scroll drop, you know, like... And so what Jesus is doing is, he's saying, in this, especially during this Holy Week, in our passions that we experience, we can abandon to God and trust him totally. And so I want to speak about the story about this saint. Her name is Chiara Badano. I really like her story because she wasn't like a saint that was made right from birth. You know, when you read the story of like Saint Faustina or Saint Catherine of Siena, you know, at the age of 6, they had mystical visions of Jesus, you know? But when I was 6 years old, I was probably picking my nose or something, right? Like, but these people were saints, you know? Like, see, Chiara Badano was just kind of like a regular girl. She liked to play tennis. She had a lot of friends. She loved to dance. She loved music. She also failed at math. So if anyone is bad at math, there's a place in heaven for you too. And there's a story that her mom recounts, and she says this. One time, I asked Chiara if she wanted to give her toys away to the children who were poor. And what Chiara did was she picked up every single one of her toys and walked away. But then, as the mother was washing the dishes, she could hear, and this one, and this one, and this one. And when she looked out, she said, Chiara, what are you doing? She's like, Mom, I want to give away these toys. Chiara, these are like your toys we just bought. I want to give them away to the poor children. So Chiara was just a regular girl, had her struggles working in holiness. At the age of 16, she was playing tennis one day, and she felt a pain in her shoulder. And when she got it diagnosed, they found out that she had a very aggressive bone cancer, the worst, osteosarcoma. And you imagine, 16, the prime of your life, and you find out you have osteosarcoma. And so she was very sad when she came home. She said, Mom, I don't want to talk right now for 20 minutes. She went to her room, and that was in a way her agony, her moment of, my God, why have you forsaken me? But in that moment, she chose to trust. And then 20 minutes later, she came out. Okay, Mom, we can talk about it now. And she came out with a radiant smile. And so as she was going through chemotherapy, her hair started falling out. This beautiful girl, and her hair is falling out. And she says, Jesus, for you. If you want it, then I want it too. People would go to the hospital to try to cheer her up, but then they would leave actually being cheered up by her. She would go around ministering to the people who were depressed in the hospital, giving them life. And then a cardinal came to visit her, and he saw this light in her eyes. He says, "Where does this light come from?" And she said, "I try to love Jesus as much as I can every day." This is an image of her right here. As she eventually was diagnosed, and she said she wasn't going to recover. You would never know she had osteosarcoma because of the smile that shone from her face. When she was undergoing surgery, she said, "I don't want to take any morphine, none at all, because I want to share as much as possible in the cross of Jesus Christ." And as she passed away, she said to her mom, "Mom, don't worry. Be happy, for I am happy." And so Chiara Badano is known as Blessed Chiara Badano now, a saint. A saint who responded with trust. Trust even in the darkest and most difficult moments. And so it's tough just to worship God in some ways. We need to kind of do the opposite in some sense. We need to reject the idols. You know what's really interesting I found out recently? Why did the Israelites have to sacrifice lambs, goats, and bulls? They had to do that because those were the Egyptian gods. And so in a way, they had to sacrifice those idols which they had formerly believed as gods, right? Think about the golden calf after Mount Sinai, right? That was the Egyptian god Apis. And so they were worshiping the bull. And so by sacrificing these gods, they would release their power and show them that they were powerless, right? Imagine if you were worshiping the god of the $1,000 bill and you burnt it one every day. You'd be like, "Man, oh, okay, well, that was really tough." But then it showed, like, that's just a $1,000 bill. And so some of the things I've tried to implement in my own life and try to kind of, like, I don't recommend, like, burning your $1,000 iPhone, because that's probably not economical. But some of the things I've done is, when I found it really tough, I turned my screen grayscale. You can actually turn your screen grayscale, and you actually notice the difference because the colors really draw you in. Because after a while, when you turn it back on, it's just like, whoa, it just kind of drawing you in. What I do is I put my phone on do not disturb permanently, except for calls. So I allow calls to come through because I found, like, no, rarely do I ever get a text that's like super urgent. And if it's urgent, usually they'll just call, right? So to not draw me into its worship in some way, right? And you'll find different ways and strategies that maybe work for you. I know some people go really radical and they get like a flip phone, like, whoa, man, like, they're really like rejecting because they just know themselves, like, man, I can't do that. Or maybe some people have flip phones, which is totally okay too. And so we need to, in a way, we need to worship God, but we need to reject the idols. And by doing this, and also what I do is I have blackout times in your day where you don't check your phone, you leave it in your drawer from 5 to 7 with dinner with the family or something like that. And what happens is we begin to create this atmosphere of silence. And in the silence, we begin to encounter God who is in the silence. Cardinal Sarah says that God drapes himself in silence. He drapes, he's there. And so in silence, that's where we need to go to meet him. But if our technology is drawing us away from it, how do we encounter him in the silence? And so what I'll do is I'll close off with this story here. And the story is about Cardinal Francis Nguyen Van Thuan. And he was like the John Paul II of the Vietnamese country, right? Like, he was like really charismatic, and the communists were afraid of him. They were afraid of what he was going to do and transform, because they saw what was happening in Poland. And so what they did was they imprisoned him for 13 years, and 9 of those years were in solitary confinement. Imagine being in a place maybe a little bit bigger than this altar, confined in just that small space. And what they would do is they would leave the light on for days, because then you wouldn't know what time it was, right? How long the days were progressing. And then for other times, they would just turn off the light and leave you in complete darkness. They try to break you mentally. So they would starve you for days, and what they would do is they'd give you all this food. And they'd open up the prison and they'd give you all this food, and what he had to do is he was hungry, so he ate it all. But then they wouldn't allow him to go out to go to the washroom. So he had to relieve himself in his cell. And so what they do is they would come in and like they'd spray him down with the hose and be like, "You call yourself a Vietnamese bishop? Is that what you're doing?" And so Cardinal Nguyen Van Thuan, he just came to the point where his mind was starting to break in some ways. Like he couldn't even say a Hail Mary or an Our Father. So at one point he was just praying, and all he could say was this. And his name is Francis. He says, "Jesus, Francis is here." And then he would hear back, "Francis, Jesus is here." And when he heard that, and in that moment, everything changed. What was a hellhole had now been transformed into something beautiful for him. It was amazing. This is what he says. "I am happy here in this cell where white mushrooms are growing on my sleeping mat because you are here with me. Because you want me to live here with you. I've spoken much in my lifetime. Now I speak no more. It's your turn to speak to me, Jesus. I am listening to you." So in the silence, he found our Lord and Savior, and it transformed him. It transformed the way he was able to interact with these prison guards. So the next time they fed him and they made him relieve himself in the cell and they're spraying him down, it's like, "Well, you're a bishop, why would you do this? What kind of man are you?" And this is what he said. He said, "I'm sorry for leaving the cell in such a mess. Thank you for cleaning my cell. I will try not to leave it in this state again." He responded with love to his captors. And at one point, he was in the cell and they kept rotating the soldiers every 2 weeks because they were afraid he was going to convert all the soldiers. But what they found out afterwards is that he was actually converting the soldiers, and they're just giving him new fodder to convert. So they just left two of these guys with him at the prison cell. And Cardinal Nguyen Van Thuan just kept talking to him and saying, "You know, I love you, you know, even though you hurt me." And the soldier, this prison guard, just had a hard time believing that. And he said this, "Do you really love me?" And Cardinal Nguyen Van Thuan said, "Yes, I really do. Even when you're imprisoned here unjustly with no trial, yes, I really do love you. And when you get out, will you tell your family to come after us and to kill us? Even if you kill me, I will continue to love you. But why? It's because Jesus told us to love our enemies. And if we don't, we are not worthy to be called the name Christian." And so, we worship what we love, and we become what we love. If we worship our technology, we become distracted, disintegrated, we can become lonely. But if we worship Jesus Christ, we become Jesus Christ. And so we become true Christians. We become one of those people who can trust in the midst of darkness. We can be one of those people who loves our enemies. In other words, we become saints. And so during this Holy Week, as we prepare and enter into our Lord's Passion, let us ask ourselves, what are we worshiping? And God, am I giving you my whole heart? And Lord, help me to draw closer to you in love and to give you my whole heart and to unite with you in your passion.